Side 4, Unfinished Tales of Numenor and Middle-earth, by J.R.R. Tolkien. Continuing with Narn Ihin Hurin, on page 88. Androg laughed.
"If that is the way of it, have your will," he said. "I make no claim to match you alone, but our fellows may take this slaying ill."
Then the woman rose to her feet and laid her hand on Turin's arm. She looked at the blood, and she looked at Turin, and there was delight in her eyes.
"Kill him, lord," she said. "Kill him too, and then come with me. If you bring their heads, Larnach, my father, will not be displeased. For 2 wolf heads he has rewarded men well." But Turin said to Androg, "Is it far to her home?"
"A mile or so," he answered, "in a fenced homestead yonder. She was straying outside."
"Go then, quickly," said Turin, turning back to the woman. "Tell your father to keep you better, but I will not cut off the heads of my fellows to buy his favor, or aught else."
Then he put up his sword.
"Come," he said to Androg, "we will return. But if you wish to bury your captain, you must do so yourself. Make haste, for a hue and cry may be raised. Bring his weapons."
Then Turin went on his way without more words, and Androg watched him go, and he frowned as one pondering a riddle. When Turin came back to the camp of the outlaws, he found them restless and ill at ease, for they had stayed too long already in one place, near to homesteads well guarded, and they murmured against Forweg.
"He runs hazards to our cost," they said, "and others may have to pay for his pleasures."
"Then choose a new captain," said Turin, standing before them. "Forweg can lead you no longer, for he is dead."
"How do you know that?" said Ulrod. "Did you seek honey from the same hive? Did the bees sting him?"
"No," said Turin.
"One sting was enough. I slew him. But I spared Androg, and he will soon return."
Then he told all that was done, rebuking those that did such deeds. And while he yet spoke, Androg returned, bearing Forweg's weapons.
"See, Nathan," he cried, "no alarm has been raised. Maybe she hopes to meet you again."
"If you jest with me," said Turin, "I shall regret that I grudged her your head. Now tell your tale, and be brief."
Then Androg told truly enough all that had befallen.
"What business Nathan had there, I now wonder," he said.
"Not ours, it seems.
For when I came up, he had already slain Forweg. The woman liked that well, and offered to go with him, begging our heads as a bride price. But he did not want her, and sped her off. So what grudge he had against the captain I cannot guess. He left my head on my shoulders, for which I am grateful, though much puzzled."
"Then I deny your claim to come to the people of Hador," said Turin. "To Uldor, the accursed, you belong rather, and should seek service with Angband.
But hear me now," he cried to them all. "These choices I give you. You must take me as your captain in Forweg's place, or else let me go. I will govern this fellowship now, or leave it. But if you wish to kill me, set to. I will fight you all until I am dead, or you."
Then many men seized their weapons, but Androg cried out,
"Nay, the head that he spared is not witless. If we fight, more than one will die needlessly before we kill the best man among us."
Then he laughed.
"As it was when he joined us, so it is again. He kills to make room. If it proved well before, so may it again, and he may lead us to better fortune than prowling about other men's middens."
And old Ogund said,
"The best man among us. Time was when we would have done the same if we dared, but we have forgotten much. He may bring us home in the end."
At that, the thought came to Turin that from this small band he might rise to build himself a free lordship of his own. But he looked at Ogund and Androg and said,
"Home, do you say?
Tall and cold stand the mountains of shadow between. Behind them are the people of Uldor, and about them the legions of Angband. If such things do not daunt you, 7 times 7 men, then I may lead you homewards. But how far before we die?"
All were silent. Then Turin spoke again.
"Do you take me to be your captain? Then I will lead you first away into the wild, far from the homes of men. There we may find better fortune or not, but at the least we shall earn less hatred of our own kind."
Then all those that were of the people of Hador gathered to him and took him as their captain, and the others, with less good will, agreed. And at once he led them away out of that country. Note 10. In a variant text of this part of the story, Turin at this time declared to the outlaws his true name, and he claimed that, being by right the lord and judge of the people of Hador, he had slain Forweg justly, since he was a man of Dor Lomen. Then Ogund, the old outlaw who had fled down Sirion from the Nirnaeth Ornoidiad, said that Turin's eyes had long reminded him of another whom he could not recall, and that now he knew him for the son of Hurin. But he was a smaller man, small for his kin, though filled with fire, and his hair gold-red. You are dark and tall. I see your mother in you, now that I look closer. She was of Beor's people. What fate was hers, I wonder? I do not know, said Turin. No word comes out of the north. In this version, it was the knowledge that Nathan was Turin, son of Hurin, that led those outlaws who came originally from Dor Lomen to accept him as the leader of the band. End of note. Many messengers had been sent out by Thingol to seek Turin within Dorioth and in the lands near its borders. But in the year of his flight, they searched for him in vain, for none knew or could guess that he was with the outlaws and enemies of men. When winter came on, they returned to the king, save Beleg only. After all others had departed, still he went on alone. But in Dimbar, and along the north marches of Dorioth, things had gone ill. The Dragonhelm was seen there in battle no longer, and the Strongbow also was missed. And the servants of Morgoth were heartened, and increased ever in numbers and in daring. Winter came, and passed, and with spring their assault was renewed. Dimbar was overrun, and the men of Brethil were afraid, for evil roamed now upon all their borders, save in the south. It was now almost a year since Turin had fled, and still Beleg sought for him with ever-lessening hope. He passed northwards in his wanderings to the crossings of Taglin, and there, hearing ill news of a new inroad of orcs out of Taur Nufuin, he turned back, and came as it chanced to the homes of the woodmen soon after Turin had left that region. There he heard a strange tale that went among them. A tall and lordly man, or an elf warrior, some said, had appeared in the woods and had slain one of the Gaerwaith and rescued the daughter of Larnach, whom they were pursuing. Very proud he was, said Larnach's daughter to Beleg, with bright eyes that scarcely deigned to look at me. Yet he called the wolfmen his fellows, and would not slay another that stood by and knew his name. Nathan, he called him.
Can you read this riddle? Asked Larnach of the elf.
I can, alas, said Beleg.
The man that you tell of is one whom I seek.
No more of Turin did he tell the woodmen, but he warned them of evil gathering northwards.
Soon the orcs will come ravening in this country in strength too great for you to withstand, he said. This year at last, you must give up your freedom or your lives. Go to Brethil, while there is time.
Then Beleg went on his way in haste, and sought for the lairs of the outlaws, and such signs as might show him whither they had gone. These he soon found, but Turin was now several days ahead, and moved swiftly, fearing the pursuit of the woodmen, and he used all the arts that he knew to defeat or mislead any that tried to follow them. Seldom did they remain 2 nights in one camp, and they left little trace of their going or staying. So it was that even Beleg hunted them in vain. Led by signs that he could read, or by the rumor of the passing of men among the wild things with whom he could speak, he came often near, but always their lair was deserted when he came to it, for they kept a watch about them by day and night. And at any rumor of approach, they were swiftly up and away.
Alas, he cried, too well did I teach this child of men craft in Wardenfield. An elvish band, almost one might think this to be.
But they, for their part, became aware that they were trailed by some tireless pursuer whom they could not see and yet could not shake off, and they grew uneasy. Note 11. The last written versions of this part of the story agree that when Turin became captain of the outlaw band, he led them away from the homes of the woodmen in the forest south of Taglin, and that Beleg came there soon after they had gone. but the geography is unclear, and the accounts of the outlaws' movements conflicting. It seems necessary to suppose, in view of the subsequent course of the narrative, that they remained in the Vale of Sirion, and indeed that they were not far from their previous haunts at the time of the orc raid on the homes of the woodmen. In one tentative version, they went away southwards and came to the country above the Ailenuiol and the fens of Sirion. But the men becoming discontented in that harbourless land, Turin was persuaded to lead them back to the woodlands south of Teiglin, where he first encountered them. This would fit the requirements of the narrative. End of note. Not long afterwards, as Beleg had feared, the orcs came across the Brithiach, and being resisted with all the force that he could muster by Handir of Brethil, they passed south over the crossings of Teiglin in search of plunder. Many of the woodmen had taken Beleg's counsel and sent their women and children to ask for refuge in Brethil. These and their escort escaped, passing over the crossings in time. But the armed men that came behind were met by the orcs, and the men were worsted. A few fought their way through and came to Brethil, but many were slain or captured. And the orcs passed on to the homesteads and sacked them and burned them. Then at once they turned back westwards, seeking the road, for they wished now to return north as swiftly as they could with their booty and their captives. But the scouts of the outlaws were soon aware of them, and though they cared little enough for the captives, the plunder of the woodmen aroused their greed. To Turin it seemed perilous to reveal themselves to the orcs until their numbers were known. But the outlaws would not heed him, for they had need of many things in the wild, and already some began to regret his leading. Therefore, taking one Orleg as his only companion, Turin went forth to spy upon the orcs. And giving command of the band to Ondrog, he charged him to lie close and well hid while they were gone. Now the orc host was far greater than the band of the outlaws, but they were in lands to which orcs had seldom dared to come. And they knew also that beyond the road lay the Talath Dirnan, the guarded plain, upon which the scouts and spies of Nargothrond kept watch. And fearing danger, they were wary, and their scouts went creeping through the trees on either side of the marching lines. Thus it was that Turin and Orleg were discovered, for three scouts stumbled upon them as they lay hid. And though they slew two, the third escaped, crying as he ran, "Galug! Galug!" Now that was a name which they had for the Noldor. At once the forest was filled with orcs, scattering silently and hunting far and wide. Then Turin, seeing that there was small hope of escape, thought at least to deceive them and to lead them away from the hiding place of his men. And perceiving from the cry of Golug that they feared the spies of Nargothrond, he fled with Orleg westward. The pursuit came swiftly after them, until turn and dodge as they would, they were driven at last out of the forest. And then they were espied, and as they sought to cross the road, Orleg was shot down by many arrows. But Turin was saved by his elven mail, and escaped alone into the wilds beyond. And by speed and craft he eluded his enemies, fleeing far into lands that were strange to him. Then the orcs, fearing that the elves of Nargothrond might be aroused, slew their captives, and made haste away into the north. Now when 3 days had passed, and yet Turin and Orleg did not return, some of the outlaws wished to depart from the cave where they lay hid. But Ondrog spoke against it. And while they were in the midst of this debate, suddenly a gray figure stood before them. Beleg had found them at last. He came forward with no weapon in his hands, and held the palms turned towards them. But they leapt up in fear, and Ondrog, coming behind, cast a noose over him, and drew it so that it pinioned his arms. "If you do not wish for guests, you should keep better watch," said Beleg. "Why do you welcome me thus? I come as a friend, and seek only a friend. Nathan, I hear that you call him." "He is not here," said Ulrod. "But unless you have long spied on us, how know you that name?" "He has long spied on us," said Ondrog. "This is the shadow that has dogged us. Now perhaps we shall learn his true purpose." Then he bade them tie Beleg to a tree beside the cave, and when he was hard bound, hand and foot, they questioned him. But to all their questions, Beleg would give one answer only. "A friend I have been to this Nathan since I first met him in the woods, and he was then but a child. I seek him only in love, and to bring him good tidings." "Let us slay him, and be rid of his spying," said Ondrog in wrath.
and he looked on the great bow of Beleg and coveted it, for he was an archer. But some of better heart spoke against him, and Ahlgund said to him, "The captain may return yet, and then you will rue it if he learns that he has been robbed at once of a friend and of good tidings." "I do not believe the tale of this elf," said Ondrog. "He is a spy of the King of Dorioth. But if he has indeed any tidings, he shall tell them to us, and we shall judge if they give us reason to let him live."
"I shall wait for your captain," said Beleg.
"You shall stand there until you speak," said Ondrog.
Then at the egging of Ondrog, they left Beleg tied to the tree without food or water, and they sat near, eating and drinking, but he said no more to them. When 2 days and nights had passed in this way, they became angry and fearful, and were eager to be gone, and most were now ready to slay the elf. As night drew down, they were all gathered about him, and Ulrod brought a brand from the little fire that was lit in the cave mouth. But at that moment, Turin returned. Coming silently, as was his custom, he stood in the shadows beyond the ring of men, and he saw the haggard face of Beleg in the light of the brand. Then he was stricken as with a shaft, and as if at the sudden melting of a frost, tears long unshed filled his eyes. He sprang out and ran to the tree.
"Beleg! Beleg!" he cried. "How have you come hither, and why do you stand so?"
At once he cut the bonds from his friend, and Beleg fell forward into his arms. When Turin heard all that the men would tell, he was angry and grieved. But at first he gave heed only to Beleg. While he tended him with what skill he had, he thought of his life in the woods, and his anger turned upon himself. For often strangers had been slain when caught near the lairs of the outlaws, or waylaid by them, and he had not hindered it. And often he himself had spoken ill of King Thingol and of the Grey Elves, so that he must share the blame if they were treated as foes. Then, with bitterness, he turned to the men.
"You were cruel," he said, "and cruel without need. Never until now have we tormented a prisoner, but to such orc work, such a life as we lead has brought us. Lawless and fruitless all our deeds have been, serving only ourselves and feeding hate in our hearts."
But Ondrog said, "Whom shall we serve, if not ourselves? Whom shall we love, when all hate us?"
"At least my hands shall not again be raised against elves or men," said Turin. "Angband has servants enough. If others will not take this vow with me, I will walk alone."
Then Beleg opened his eyes and raised his head.
"Not alone," he said. "Now at last I can tell my tidings. You are no outlaw, and Nathon is a name unfit. Such fault as was found in you is pardoned. For a year you have been sought to recall you to honor and to the service of the king. The Dragonhelm has been missed too long."
But Turin showed no joy in this news and sat long in silence. For at Beleg's words a shadow fell upon him again.
"Let this night pass," he said at length. "Then I will choose. However it goes, we must leave this lair tomorrow, for not all who seek us wish us well."
"Nay, none," said Ondrog, and he cast an evil look at Beleg. In the morning Beleg, being swiftly healed of his pains, after the manner of the elven folk of old, spoke to Turin apart.
"I looked for more joy at my tidings," he said. "Surely you will return now to Dorioth?"
And he begged Turin to do this in all ways that he could, but the more he urged it, the more Turin hung back. Nonetheless, he questioned Beleg closely concerning the judgment of Thingol. Then Beleg told him all that he knew, and at the last Turin said,
"Then Mablung proved my friend, as he once seemed?"
"The friend of truth, rather," said Beleg.
"And that was best, in the end."
"But why, Turin, did you not speak to him of Syros' assault upon you? All otherwise might things have gone, and," he said, looking at the men sprawled near the mouth of the cave, "you might have held your helm still high, and not fallen to this."
"That may be, if fall you call it," said Turin.
"That may be."
But so it went, and words stuck in my throat. There was reproof in his eyes, without question asked of me, for a deed I had not done. My man's heart was proud, as the elf king said.
and so it still is, Beleg Cuthalion. Not yet will it suffer me to go back to Menegroth and bear looks of pity and pardon, as for a wayward boy amended. I should give pardon, not receive it. And I am a boy no longer, but a man, according to my kind, and a hard man by my fate. Then Beleg was troubled.
What will you do, then? He asked.
Fare free, said Turin.
That wish Mablun gave me at our parting. The grace of Thingol will not stretch to receive these companions of my fall, I think.
But I will not part with them now, if they do not wish to part with me. I love them in my way, even the worst a little. They are of my own kind, and there is some good in each that might grow. I think that they will stand by me.
You see with other eyes than mine, said Beleg. If you try to wean them from evil, they will fail you.
I doubt them, and one most of all.
How shall an elf judge of men, said Turin.
As he judges all deeds, by whomsoever done, answered Beleg. But he said no more, and did not speak of Ondrog's malice, to which his evil handling had been chiefly due. For perceiving Turin's mood, he feared to be disbelieved, and to hurt their old friendship, driving Turin back to his evil ways.
Fare free, you say? Turin, my friend, he said. What is your meaning?
I would lead my own men, and make war in my own way, Turin answered. But in this at least my heart is changed. I repent every stroke, save those dealt against the enemy of men and elves, and above all else I would have you beside me. Stay with me.
If I stayed beside you, love would lead me, not wisdom, said Beleg. My heart warns me that we should return to Dorioth.
Nonetheless, I will not go there, said Turin. Then Beleg strove once more to persuade him to return to the service of King Thingol, saying that there was great need of his strength and valor on the north marches of Dorioth. And he spoke to him of the new inroads of the orcs, coming down into Dimbar, out of Tau Nufuin, by the pass of Anach. But all his words were of no avail, and at last he said,
A hard man you have called yourself, Turin.
Hard you are, and stubborn. Now the turn is mine. If you wish indeed to have the strongbow beside you, look for me in Dimbar, for thither I shall return. Then Turin sat in silence, and strove with his pride, which would not let him turn back, and he brooded on the years that lay behind him. But coming suddenly out of his thought, he said to Beleg, The elf maiden whom you named, I owe her well for her timely witness, yet I cannot recall her. Why did she watch my ways? Then Beleg looked strangely at him.
Why indeed, he said. Turin, have you lived always with your heart and half your mind far away? You walked with Nelos in the woods of Dorioth when you were a boy.
That was long ago, said Turin, or so my childhood now seems, and a mist is over it, save only the memory of my father's house in Dor Lomond.
But why should I have walked with an elf maiden?
To learn what she could teach, maybe, said Beleg.
Alas, child of men, there are other griefs in Middle-earth than yours, and wounds made by no weapon.
Indeed, I begin to think that elves and men should not meet or meddle. Turin said nothing, but looked long in Beleg's face, as if he would read in it the riddle of his words. But Nelos of Dorioth never saw him again, and his shadow passed from her. Note 12. In the Silmarillion, the narrative continues, pages 201 and 202, with Beleg's farewell to Turin, Turin's strange foreknowledge that his fate would lead him to Amon-Ruth, Beleg's coming to Menegroth, where he received the sword Anglachel from Thingol and Lembas from Melion, and his return to warfare against the orcs in Dimbar. There is no other text to supplement this, and the passage is omitted here. End of note. Of Mim the Dwarf. After the departure of Beleg, and that was in the second summer after the flight of Turin from Dorioth, things went ill for the outlaws. Note 13. Turin fled from Dorioth in the summer. He passed the autumn and winter among the outlaws, and he slew Forweg and became their captain in the spring of the next year. The events described here took place in the summer following. End of note. There were rains out of season, and orcs in greater numbers than before came down from the north and along the old south road over Teiglen, troubling all the woods on the west borders of Dorioth. There was little safety or rest, and the company were more often hunted than hunters. One night, as they lay lurking in the fireless dark, Turin looked on his life, and it seemed to him that it might well be bettered. "I must find some secure refuge," he thought, "and make provision against winter and hunger." And the next day he led his men away, further than they had yet come from the Teiglen and the marches of Dorioth. After 3 days' journeying, they halted at the western edge of the woods of Sirion's Vale. There the land was drier and more bare, as it began to climb up into the moorlands. Soon after, it chanced that as the gray light of a day of rain was failing, Turin and his men were sheltering in a holly thicket, and beyond it was a treeless space in which there were many great stones, leaning or tumbled together. All was still, save for the drip of rain from the leaves. Suddenly a watchman gave a call, and leaping up they saw three hooded shapes, gray-clad, going stealthily among the stones. They were burdened each with a great sack, but they went swiftly for all that. Turin cried out to them to halt, and the men ran out on them like hounds. But they held on their way, and though Andrag shot arrows after them, two vanished in the dusk. One lagged behind, being slower or more heavily burdened, and he was soon seized and thrown down, and held by many hard hands, though he struggled and bit like a beast. But Turin came up and rebuked his men. "What have you there?" he said. "What need to be so fierce? It is old and small. What harm is in it?" "It bites," said Andrag, showing his hand that bled. "It is an orc, or of orc kin. Kill it." "It deserves no less for cheating our hope," said another, who had taken the sack. "There is nothing here but roots and small stones." "Nay," said Turin, "it is bearded. It is only a dwarf, I guess. Let him up and speak." So it was that Mim came into the tale of the children of Hurin, for he stumbled up on his knees before Turin's feet and begged for his life. "I am old," he said, "and poor. Only a dwarf, as you say, and not an orc. Mim is my name. Do not let them slay me, lord, for no cause, as would the orcs." Then Turin pitied him in his heart, but he said, "Poor you seem, Mim, though that is strange in a dwarf. But we are poorer, I think, houseless and friendless men. If I said that we do not spare for pity's sake only, being in great need, what would you offer for ransom?" "I do not know what you desire, lord," said Mim, warily. "At this time, little enough," said Turin, looking about him bitterly with rain in his eyes. "A safe place to sleep in out of the damp woods? Doubtless you have such for yourself." "I have," said Mim, "but I cannot give it in ransom. I am too old to live under the sky." "You need grow no older," said Andrag, stepping up with a knife in his unharmed hand. "I can spare you that." "Lord," cried Mim then in great fear, "if I lose my life, you will lose the dwelling, for you will not find it without Mim. I cannot give it, but I will share it. There is more room in it than once there was. So many have gone forever." And he began to weep. "Your life is spared, Mim," said Turin. "Till we come to his lair, at least," said Andrag. But Turin turned upon him and said, "If Mim brings us to his home without trickery, and is good, then his life is ransomed, and he shall not be slain by any man who follows me. So I swear." Then Mim clasped Turin about his knees, saying, "Mim will be your friend, lord. At first I thought you were an elf by your speech and your voice, but if you are a man, that is better. Mim does not love elves." "Where is this house of yours?" said Andrag. "It must be good indeed if Andrag is to share it with a dwarf, for Andrag does not like dwarves. His people brought few good tales of that race out of the east." "Judge my home when you see it," said Mim. "But you will need light on the way, you stumbling men. I will return in good time and lead you." "No, no," said Andrag. "You will not allow this, surely, captain.
You would never see the old rascal again.
It is growing dark, said Turin. Let him leave us some pledge.
Shall we keep your sack and its load, Mim?
But at this the dwarf fell on his knees again in great trouble.
If Mim did not mean to return, he would not return for an old sack of roots, he said. I will come back. Let me go.
I will not, said Turin. If you will not part with your sack, you must stay with it. A night under the leaves will make you pity us in your turn, maybe. But he marked, and others also, that Mim set more value on his load than it seemed worth to the eye. They led the old dwarf away to their dismal camp, and as he went, he muttered in a strange tongue that seemed harsh with ancient hatred. But when they put bonds on his legs, he went suddenly quiet, and those who were on the watch saw him sitting on through the night silent and still as stone, save for his sleepless eyes that glinted as they roved in the dark. Before morning the rain ceased, and a wind stirred in the trees. Dawn came more brightly than for many days, and light airs from the south opened the sky, pale and clear about the rising of the sun. Mim sat on without moving, and he seemed as if dead, for now the heavy lids of his eyes were closed, and the morning light showed him withered and shrunken with age. Turin stood and looked down on him. "There's light enough now," he said. Then Mim opened his eyes and pointed to his bonds, and when he was released, he spoke fiercely.
"Learn this, fools," he said. "Do not put bonds on a dwarf. He will not forgive it. I do not wish to die. But for what you have done, my heart is hot. I repent my promise."
"But I do not," said Turin. "You will lead me to your home. Till then we will not speak of death. That is my will."
He looked steadfastly in the eyes of the dwarf, and Mim could not endure it. Few indeed could challenge the eyes of Turin in set will or in wrath. Soon he turned away his head and rose.
"Follow me, lord," he said.
"Good," said Turin. "But now I will add this. I understand your pride. You may die, but you shall not be set in bonds again." Then Mim led them back to the place where he had been captured, and he pointed westward.
"There is my home," he said. "You have often seen it, I guess, for it is tall. Sharbhund, we called it, before the elves changed all the names."
Then they saw that he was pointing to Amonrúth, the bald hill, whose bare head watched over many leagues of the wild.
"We have seen it, but never nearer," said Andrag. "For what safe lair can be there, or water, or any other thing that we need? I guessed that there was some trick. Do men hide on a hilltop?"
"Long sight may be safer than lurking," said Turin. "Amonrúth gazes far and wide."
"Well, Mim, I will come and see what you have to show.
How long will it take us, stumbling men, to come thither?"
"All this day until dusk," Mim answered.
The company set out westward, and Turin went at the head with Mim at his side. They walked warily when they left the woods, but all the land was empty and quiet. They passed over the tumbled stones and began to climb, for Amonrúth stood upon the eastern edge of the high moorlands that rose between the vales of Sirion and Narog. And even above the stony heath at its base, its crown was reared up 1,000 feet and more. Upon the eastern side, a broken land climbed slowly up to the high ridges among knots of birch and rowan, and ancient thorn trees rooted in rock. About the lower slopes of Amonrúth there grew thickets of aiglos, but its steep gray head was bare, save for the red sarigon that mantled the stone. Note 14. Aiglos, snowthorn, is said to have been like firs, gorse, but larger and with white flowers. Aiglos was also the name of the spear of Gilgalad. Sarigon, blood of stone, was a plant of the kind called in English stonecrop. It had flowers of a deep red. End of note. As the afternoon was waning, the outlaws drew near to the roots of the hill. They came now from the north, for so Mim had led them, and the light of the westering sun fell upon the crown of Amonrúth, and the sarigon was all in flower.
"See, there is blood on the hilltop," said Andrag.
"Not yet," said Turin.
The sun was sinking, and light was falling in the hollows. The hill now loomed up before them and above them, and they wondered what need there could be of a guide to so plain a mark.
But as Mim led them on, and they began to climb the last steep slopes, they perceived that he was following some path by secret signs or old custom. Now his course wound to and fro, and if they looked aside, they saw that at either hand dark dells and chines opened, or the land ran down into wastes of great stones, with falls and holes masked by bramble and thorn. There, without a guide, they might have labored and clambered for days to find a way. At length they came to steeper but smoother ground. They passed under the shadows of ancient rowan trees into aisles of long-legged iglos, a gloom filled with a sweet scent. Note 15. So also the yellow-flowered gorse bushes encountered by Frodo, Sam, and Gollum in Ithilien were gaunt and leggy below but thick above, so that they could walk upright under them, passing through long, dry aisles, and they bore flowers that glimmered in the gloom and gave a faint, sweet scent. The Two Towers, 4, 7. End of note. Then suddenly there was a rock wall before them, flat-faced and sheer, towering high above them in the dusk. "Is this the door of your house?" said Turin. "Dwarves love stone," it is said. He drew close to Mim, lest he should play them some trick at the last. "Not the door of the house, but the gate of the garth," said Mim. Then he turned to the right along the cliff foot, and after 20 paces halted suddenly, and Turin saw that by the work of hands or of weather there was a cleft so shaped that two faces of the wall overlapped, and an opening ran back to the left between them. Its entrance was shrouded by long trailing plants rooted in crevices above, but within there was a steep stony path going upwards in the dark. Water trickled down it, and it was dank. One by one they filed up. At the top, the path turned right and south again, and brought them through a thicket of thorns out upon a green flat, through which it ran on into the shadows. They had come to Mim's house, Bar en Nibin Noig, which only ancient tales in Doriath and Nergothrond remembered, and no men had seen. Note 16. Elsewhere, the Sindarin name of the petty dwarves is given as Noigith Nibin, so in the Silmarillion, page 204. And Nibin Nogrim, the high moorlands that rose between the vales of Sirion and Narog, northeast of Nargothrond, page 99 above, are more than once referred to as the Moors of the Nibin Noig, or variants of this name. End of note. But night was falling, and the east was starlit, and they could not yet see how this strange place was shaped. Amenruth had a crown, a great mass like a steep cap of stone with a bare flattened top. Upon its north side there stood out from it a shelf, level and almost square, which could not be seen from below. For behind it stood the hill crown like a wall, and west and east from its brink sheer cliffs fell. Only from the north, as they had come, could it be reached with ease by those who knew the way. Note 17. The tall cliff through which Mim led them by the cleft that he called the Gate of the Garth was, it appears, the north edge of the shelf. The cliffs on the eastern and western sides were much more precipitous. End of note. From the cleft a path led, and passed soon into a little grove of dwarfed birches, growing about a clear pool in a rock-hewn basin. This pool was fed by a spring at the foot of the wall behind, and through a runnel it spilled like a white thread over the western brink of the shelf. Behind the screen of the trees near the spring, between two tall buttresses of rock, there was a cave. No more than a shallow grot, it looked, with a low broken arch. But further in it had been deepened, and bored far under the hill by the slow hands of the petty dwarves in the long years that they had dwelt there, untroubled by the gray elves of the woods. Through the deep dusk, Mim led them past the pool, where now the faint stars were mirrored among the shadows of the birch boughs. At the mouth of the cave he turned and bowed to Turin. "Enter," he said. "Bar en Dunwith, the House of Ransom, for so it shall be called." "That may be," said Turin. "I will look first." Then he went in with Mim, and the others, seeing him unafraid, followed behind, even Ondrog, who most misdoubted the dwarf. They were soon in a black dark, but Mim clapped his hands, and a little light appeared, coming round a corner. From a passage at the back of the outer grot there stepped another dwarf, bearing a small torch.
"Ha! I missed him, as I feared," said Ondrog.
But Mim spoke quickly with the other in their own harsh tongue, and seeming troubled or angered by what he heard, he darted into the passage and disappeared. Then Ondrog was all for going forward.
"Attack first," he said. "There may be a hive of them, but they are small."
Three only, I guess, said Turin, and he led the way, while behind him the outlaws groped along the passage by the feel of the rough walls. Many times it bent this way and that at sharp angles, but at last a faint light gleamed ahead, and they came into a small but lofty hall, dim-lit by lamps hanging down out of the roof shadow upon fine chains. Mem was not there, but his voice could be heard, and led by it, Turin came to the door of a chamber opening at the back of the hall. Looking in, he saw Mem kneeling on the floor. Beside him stood silent the dwarf with the torch, but on a stone couch by the further wall there lay another.
Kahim! Kahim! Kahim!
The old dwarf wailed, tearing at his beard.
Not all your shafts went wild, said Turin to Androg. But this may prove an ill hit. You loose shaft too lightly, but you may not live long enough to learn wisdom.
Then, entering softly, Turin stood behind Mim and spoke to him.
What is the trouble, Mim? He said. I have some healing arts. Can I give you aid?
Mim turned his head, and there was a red light in his eyes.
Not unless you can turn back time, and then cut off the cruel hands of your men, he answered. This is my son, pierced by an arrow. Now he is beyond speech. He died at sunset. Your bonds held me from healing him.
Again, pity long hardened welled in Turin's heart as water from rock.
Alas, he said, I would recall that shaft if I could. Now, Barren Dunwith, House of Ransom, shall this be called in truth. For whether we dwell here or no, I will hold myself in your debt. And if ever I come to any wealth, I will pay you a ransom of heavy gold for your son, in token of sorrow, though it gladden your heart no more.
Then Mim rose and looked long at Turin.
I hear you, he said. You speak like a dwarf lord of old, and at that I marvel. Now my heart is cooled, though it is not glad. My own ransom I will pay, therefore. You may dwell here, if you will. But this I will add. He that loosed the shaft shall break his bow and his arrows and lay them at my son's feet, and he shall never take arrow nor bear bow again. If he does, he shall die by it. That curse I lay on him.
Androg was afraid when he heard of this curse, and though he did so with great grudge, he broke his bow and his arrows and laid them at the dead dwarf's feet. But as he came out from the chamber, he glanced evilly at Mim and muttered,
The curse of a dwarf never dies, they say, but a man's too may come home. May he die with a dart in his throat.
Note 18. Androg's curse is also recorded in the form, May he lack a bow at need ere his end. In the event, Mim met his death from Hurin's sword before the doors of Nargothrond. The Silmarillion, page 230. End of note. That night, they lay in the hall and slept uneasily for the wailing of Mim and of Ibun, his other son. When that ceased, they could not tell, but when they woke at last, the dwarves were gone, and the chamber was closed by a stone. The day was fair again, and in the morning sun the outlaws washed in the pool and prepared such food as they had, and as they ate, Mim stood before them. He bowed to Turin.
He is gone, and all is done, he said. He lies with his fathers. Now we turn to such life as is left, though the days before us may be short. Does Mim's home please you? Is the ransom paid and accepted?
It is, said Turin.
Then all is yours, to order your dwelling here as you will, save this. The chamber that is closed, none shall open it but me.
We hear you, said Turin. But as for our life here, we are secure, or so it seems. But still we must have food and other things. How shall we go out? Or still more, how shall we return? To their disquiet, Mim laughed in his throat.
Do you fear that you have followed a spider to the heart of his web? He said. Mim does not eat men, and a spider could ill deal with 30 wasps at a time. See, you are armed, and I stand here bare. No, we must share, you and I. House, food, and fire, and maybe other winnings. The house I think you will guard and keep secret for your own good, even when you know the ways in and out. You will learn them in time. But in the meanwhile, Mim must guide you, or Ibun, his son.
To this, Turin agreed, and he thanked Mim, and most of his men were glad, for under the sun of morning, while summer was yet high, it seemed a fair place to dwell in. Andrag alone was ill-content.
The sooner we are masters of our goings and comings, the better, he said. Never before have we taken a prisoner with a grievance to and fro on our ventures.
That day they rested and cleaned their arms and mended their gear, for they had food to last for a day or two yet, and Mim added to what they had. 3 great cooking pots he lent to them, and firing also, and he brought out a sack.
Rubbish, he said, not worth the stealing, only wild roots.
But when they were cooked, these roots proved good to eat, somewhat like bread, and the outlaws were glad of them, for they had long lacked bread save when they could steal it.
Wild elves know them not. Grey elves have not found them. The proud ones from over the sea are too proud to delve, said Mim.
What is their name? Said Turin. Mim looked at him sidelong.
They have no name, save in the dwarf tongue, which we do not teach, he said. And we do not teach men to find them, for men are greedy and thriftless, and would not spare till all the plants had perished, whereas now they pass them by as they go blundering in the wild. No more will you learn of me, but you may have enough of my bounty, as long as you speak fair and do not spy or steal.
Then again he laughed in his throat.
They are of great worth, he said, more than gold in the hungry winter, for they may be hoarded like the nuts of a squirrel, and already we were building our store from the first that are ripe. But you are fools if you think that I would not be parted from one small load, even for the saving of my life.
I hear you, said Ulrad, who had looked in the sack when Mim was taken.
Yet you would not be parted, and your words only make me wonder the more.
Mim turned and looked at him darkly.
You are one of the fools that spring would not mourn if you perished in winter, he said. I had spoken my word, and so must have returned, willing or not, with sack or without. Let a lawless and faithless man think what he will. But I like not to be parted from my own by force of the wicked, be it no more than a shoe-thong. Do I not remember that your hands were among those that put bonds on me, and so held me that I did not speak again with my son? Ever when I deal out the earth-bread from my store, you shall be counted out. And if you eat it, you shall eat by the bounty of your fellows, not of me.
Then Mim went away, but Ulrad, who had quailed under his anger, spoke to his back.
High words! Nonetheless, the old rogue had other things in his sack, of like shape, but harder and heavier. Maybe there are other things beside earth-bread in the wild which elves have not found and men must not know.
Note 19. The mystery of the other things in Mim's sack is not explained. The only other statement on the subject is in a hastily scribbled note, which suggests that there were ingots of gold disguised as roots, and refers to Mim seeking for old treasures of a dwarf house near the flat stones. These were no doubt those referred to in the text, page 96, as great stones, leaning or tumbled together, at the place where Mim was captured. But there is nowhere any indication of what part this treasure was to play in the story of Bar and Donwith. End of note.
That may be, said Turin. Nonetheless, the dwarf spoke the truth in one point at least, calling you a fool. Why must you speak your thoughts? Silence, if fair words stick in your throat, would serve all our ends better.
The day passed in peace, and none of the outlaws desired to go abroad. Turin paced much upon the green sward of the shelf, from brink to brink, and he looked out east and west and north, and wondered to find how far were the views in the clear air. Northward he looked, and descried the forest of Brethil, climbing green about Amon Obel in its midst. And thither his eyes were drawn ever and again, he knew not why, for his heart was set rather to the northwest, where league upon league away on the skirts of the sky, it seemed to him that he could glimpse the mountains of shadow, the walls of his home. But at evening, Turin looked west into the sunset as the sun rode down red into the hazes above the distant coasts, and the Vale of Narog lay deep in the shadows between. So began the abiding of Turin, son of Hurin, in the halls of Mim, in Bar and Donwev, the House of Ransom. Editor, for the story of Turin from his coming to Bar and Donwev to the fall of Nargothrond, see the Silmarillion, pages 204 to 215, and the appendix to the Narn I Hin Hurin, page 150 below. Author: The Return of Turin to Dor Lomond. At last, worn by haste and the long road, for 40 leagues and more had he journeyed without rest, Turin came with the first ice of winter to the pools of Ivrin, where before he had been healed. But they were now only a frozen mire, and he could drink there no more. Thence he came to the passes in Dorloman, and snow came bitterly from the north, and the ways were perilous and cold. Note 20. It is said on page 69 that the pass over the shoulder of Amundarthir was the only pass between Serech and far westward where Dorloman marched with Nevrost. End of note. Though 23 years were gone since he had trodden that path, it was graven in his heart, so great was the sorrow of each step at the parting from Morwen. Thus at last he came back to the land of his childhood. It was bleak and bare, and the people there were few and churlish, and they spoke the harsh tongue of the Easterlings, and the old tongue was become the language of serfs, or of foes. Therefore Turin walked warily, hooded and silent, and he came at last to the house that he sought. It stood empty and dark, and no living thing dwelt near it, for Morwen was gone, and Broda, the incomer, he that took by force Irin, Hurin's kinswoman, to wife, had plundered her house and taken all that was left to her of goods or of servants. Broda's house stood nearest to the old house of Hurin, and thither Turin came, spent with wandering and grief, begging for shelter. And it was granted to him, for some of the kindlier manners of old were still kept there by Irin. He was given a seat by a fire among the servants, and a few vagabonds well nigh as grim and wayworn as he, and he asked news of the land. At that the company fell silent, and some drew away, looking askance at the stranger. But one old vagabond man with a crutch said,
"If you must speak the old tongue, master, speak it softer, and ask for no tidings. Would you be beaten for a rogue, or hung for a spy? For both you may well be by the looks of you, which is but to say," he said, coming near and speaking low in Turin's ear, "one of the kindly folk of old, that came with Hador in the days of gold, before heads wore wolf hair. Some here are of that sort, though now made beggars and slaves. And but for the Lady Irin would get neither this fire nor this broth. Whence are you, and what news would you have?"
"There was a lady called Morwen," answered Turin, "and long ago I lived in her house. Thither after far wandering I came to seek welcome, but neither fire nor folk are there now."
"Nor have been this long year and more," answered the old man. "But scant were both fire and folk in that house since the deadly war, for she was of the old people, as doubtless you know, the widow of our lord, Hurin Galdor's son. They dared not touch her, though, for they feared her, proud and fair as a queen, before sorrow marred her. Witchwife, they called her, and shunned her. Witchwife. It is but elf friend in the new language. Yet they robbed her. Often would she and her daughter have gone hungry, but for the Lady Irin. She aided them in secret, it is said, and was often beaten for it by the churl Broda, her husband, by need."
"And this long year and more," said Turin, "are they dead, or made thralls, or have the orcs assailed her?"
"It is not known, for sure," said the old man, "but she is gone with her daughter, and this Broda has plundered her and stripped what remained. Not a dog is left, and her few folk made his slaves, save some that have gone begging, as have I. I served her many a year, and the great master before, Sador Onefoot. A cursed axe in the woods long ago, or I would be lying in the great mound now. Well, I remember the day Hurin's boy was sent away, and how he wept, and she, when he was gone. To the hidden kingdom he went, it was said."
With that the old man stayed his tongue and eyed Turin doubtfully.
"I am old and I babble," he said. "Mind me not. But though it is pleasant to speak the old tongue with one that speaks it fair as in time past, the days are ill and one must be wary. Not all that speak the fair tongue are fair at heart."
"Truly," said Turin, "my heart is grim. But if you fear that I am a spy of the north or the east, then you have little more wisdom than you had long ago, Sador Labadal."
The old man eyed him agape, then trembling he spoke.
"Come outside. It is colder, but safer. You speak too loud, and I too much for an Easterling's hall."
When they were come into the court, he clutched at Turin's cloak.
Long ago you dwelt in that house, you say? Lord Turin, son of Hurin, why have you come back? My eyes are opened and my ears at last. You have the voice of your father. But young Turin alone ever gave me that name, Labadal. He meant no ill. We were merry friends in those days. What does he seek here now? Few are we left, and we are old and weaponless. Happier are those in the great mound.
I did not come with thought of battle, said Turin, though your words have waked the thought in me now, Labadal. But it must wait. I came seeking the Lady Morwen and Nienor. What can you tell me, and swiftly?
Little lord, said Sador, they went away, secretly. It was whispered among us that they were summoned by the Lord Turin, for we did not doubt that he had grown great in the years, a king or a lord in some south country. But it seems that is not so.
It is not, answered Turin. A lord I was in a south country, though now I am a vagabond, but I did not summon them.
Then I know not what to tell you, said Sador. But the Lady Irin will know, I doubt not. She knew all the counsel of your mother.
How can I come to her?
That I know not. It would cost her much pain were she caught whispering at a door with a wandering wretch of the downtrod people, even could any message call her forth. And such a beggar as you are will not walk far up the hall towards the high board before the Easterling sees him and beat him, or worse.
Then in anger Turin cried,
May I not walk up Broda's hall, and will they beat me? Come and see.
Thereupon he went into the hall, and cast back his hood, and thrusting aside all in his path, he strode towards the board where sat the master of the house, and his wife, and other Easterling lords. Then some ran to seize him, but he flung them to the ground, and cried,
Does no one rule this house, or is it an orkhold? Where is the master?
Then Broda rose in wrath.
I rule this house, said he.
But before he could say more, Turin said,
Then you have not learned the courtesy that was in this land before you. Is it now the manner of men to let lackeys mishandle the kinsmen of their wives?
Such am I, and I have an errand to the Lady Irin. Shall I come freely, or shall I come as I will?
Come, said Broda, and he scowled.
But Irin turned pale. Then Turin strode to the high board, and stood before it, and bowed.
Your pardon, Lady Irin, he said, that I break in upon you thus. But my errand is urgent, and has brought me far. I seek Morwen, Lady of Dorloman, and Nienor her daughter, but her house is empty and plundered. What can you tell me?
Nothing, said Irin, in great fear, for Broda watched her narrowly.
Nothing, save that she is gone.
That I do not believe, said Turin.
Then Broda sprang forth, and he was red with drunken rage.
No more, he cried. Shall my wife be gainsaid before me by a beggar that speaks the serf tongue? There is no lady of Dorloman. But as for Morwen, she was of the thrall folk, and has fled as thralls will. Do you likewise, and swiftly, or I will have you hung on a tree.
Then Turin leapt at him, and drew his black sword, and seized Broda by the hair, and laid back his head.
Let no one stir, said he, or this head will leave its shoulders. Lady Irin, I would beg your pardon once more, if I thought that this churl had ever done you anything but wrong. But speak now, and do not deny me. Am I not Turin, Lord of Dorloman? Shall I command you?
Command me, she answered.
Who plundered the house of Morwen?
Broda, she answered.
When did she flee, and whither?
A year and 3 months gone, said Irin. Master Broda and others of the incomers of the East hereabout oppressed her sorely. Long ago she was bidden to the Hidden Kingdom, and she went forth at last. For the lands between were then free of evil for a while, because of the prowess of the Black Sword of the South Country, it is said. But that now is ended. She looked to find her son there awaiting her. But if you are he, then I fear that all has gone awry.
Then Turin laughed bitterly.
Awry? Awry? He cried.
Yes, ever awry. As crooked as Morgoth.
And suddenly a black wrath shook him, for his eyes were opened, and the spell of Glaurung loosed its last threads, and he knew the lies with which he had been cheated.
Have I been cozened, that I might come and die here dishonored, who might at least have ended valiantly before the doors of Nargothrond?
And out of the night, about the hall, it seemed to him that he heard the cries of Finduilas.
Not first will I die here,
he cried, and he seized Brodda, and with the strength of his great anguish and wrath, he lifted him on high and shook him as if he were a dog.
Morwen, of the thrall folk, did you say? You son of dastards, thief, slave of slaves!
Thereupon he flung Brodda head foremost across his own table, full in the face of an Easterling that rose to assail Turin. In that fall, Brodda's neck was broken, and Turin leapt after his cast and slew three more that cowered there, for they were caught weaponless. There was tumult in the hall. The Easterlings that sat there would have come against Turin, but many others were gathered there of the elder people of Dor Lomond. Long had they been tame servants, but now they rose with shouts in rebellion. Soon there was great fighting in the hall, and though the thralls had but meat knives and such things as they could snatch up against daggers and swords, many were quickly slain on either hand, before Turin leapt down among them and slew the last of the Easterlings that remained in the hall. Then he rested, leaning against a pillar, and the fire of his rage was as ashes. But old Sador crept up to him and clutched him about the knees, for he was wounded to the death.
"Thrice 7 years and more. It was long to wait for this hour," he said. "But now go, go, Lord, go and do not come back, unless with greater strength. They will raise the land against you. Many have run from the hall. Go, or you will end here. Farewell."
Then he slipped down and died.
"He speaks with the truth of death," said Irin. "You have learned what you would. Now go swiftly. But go first to Morwen and comfort her, or I will hold all the rack you have wrought here hard to forgive. For ill though my life was, you have brought death to me with your violence. The incomers will avenge this night on all that were here. Rash are your deeds, son of Hurin, as if you were still but the child that I knew."
"And faint heart is yours, Irin Indor's daughter, as it was when I called you aunt, and a rough dog frightened you," said Turin. "You were made for a kinder world. But come away. I will bring you to Morwen."
"The snow lies on the land, but deeper upon my head," she answered. "I should die as soon in the wild with you as with the brute Easterlings. You cannot mend what you have done.
Go. To stay will make all the worse, and rob Morwen to no purpose. Go, I beg you."
Then Turin bowed low to her, and turned and left the hall of Brodda. But all the rebels that had the strength followed him. They fled towards the mountains, for some among them knew well the ways of the wild, and they blessed the snow that fell behind them and covered their trail. Thus, though soon the hunt was up, with many men and dogs and braying of horses, they escaped south into the hills. Then, looking back, they saw a red light far off in the land they had left.
"They have fired the hall," said Turin.
"To what purpose is that?"
"They?
No, Lord. She, I guess," said one, Ascon by name. "Many a man of arms misreads patience and quiet. She did much good among us, at much cost. Her heart was not faint, and patience will break at the last."
Now some of the hardiest that could endure the winter stayed with Turin, and led him by strange paths to a refuge in the mountains, a cave known to outlaws and runagates, and some store of food was hidden there. There they waited until the snow ceased, and then they gave him food and took him to a pass little used that led south to Sirion's Vale, where the snow had not come. On the downward path they parted.
"Farewell now, Lord of Dor Lomond," said Ascon, "but do not forget us. We shall be hunted men now, and the wolf folk will be crueler because of your coming. Therefore go, and do not return, unless you come with strength to deliver us. Farewell."
The Coming of Turin into Brethil. Now Turin went down towards Sirion, and he was torn in mind. For it seemed to him that whereas before he had two bitter choices, now there were three, and his oppressed people called him, upon whom he had brought only increase of woe. This comfort only he had, that beyond doubt, Morwen and Nienor had come long since to Dorioth, and only by the prowess of the black sword of Nargothrond had their road been made safe. And he said in his thought, "Where else better might I have bestowed them, had I come indeed sooner? If the girdle of Melion be broken, then is all ended. Nay, it is better as things be, for by my wrath and rash deeds I cast a shadow wherever I dwell.
Let Melion keep them, and I will leave them in peace, unshadowed for a while. But too late, Turin now sought for Finduilas, roaming the woods under the eaves of arid Wethryn, wild and wary as a beast, and he waylaid all the road that went north to the pass of Sirion. Too late, for all trails had been washed away by the rains and the snows. But thus it was that Turin, passing down Taglin, came upon some of the people of Holoth from the forest of Brethil. They were dwindled now by war to a small people, and dwelt for the most part secretly within a stockade upon Amon Obel, deep in the forest. Efel Brondir, that place was named, for Brondir, son of Hondir, was now their lord, since his father was slain. And Brondir was no man of war, being lamed by a leg broken in a misadventure in childhood. And he was, moreover, gentle in mood, loving wood rather than metal, and the knowledge of things that grow in the earth rather than other lore. But some of the woodmen still hunted the orcs on their borders, and thus it was that as Turin came thither, he heard the sound of an affray. He hastened towards it, and coming warily through the trees, he saw a small band of men surrounded by orcs. They defended themselves desperately, with their backs to a knot of trees that grew apart in a glade. But the orcs were in great number, and they had little hope of escape, unless help came. Therefore, out of sight in the underwood, Turin made a great noise of stamping and crashing, and then he cried in a loud voice, as if leading many men.
Ha! Here we find them! Follow me all! Out now, and slay!
At that, many of the orcs looked back in dismay, and then out came Turin, leaping, waving as if to men behind, and the edges of Girthong flickered like flame in his hand. Too well was that blade known to the orcs, and even before he sprang among them, many scattered and fled. Then the woodmen ran to join him, and together they hunted their foes into the river. Few came across. At last they halted on the bank, and Dorlos, leader of the woodmen, said,
"You are swift in the hunt, lord, but your men are slow to follow."
"Nay," said Turin, "we all run together as one man, and will not be parted."
Then the men of Brethil laughed, and said,
"Well, one such is worth many, and we owe you great thanks. But who are you, and what do you here?"
"I do but follow my trade, which is orc slaying," said Turin, "and I dwell where my trade is. I am wild man of the woods."
"Then come and dwell with us," said they, "for we dwell in the woods, and we have need of such craftsmen. You would be welcome."
Then Turin looked at them strangely, and said,
"Are there then any left who will suffer me to darken their doors? But, friends, I have still a grievous errand, to find Finduilas, daughter of Aradreth of Nargothrond, or at least to learn news of her. Alas, many weeks is it since she was taken from Nargothrond, but still I must go seeking."
Then they looked on him with pity, and Dorlos said,
"Seek no more, for an orc host came up from Nargothrond towards the crossings of Taglin, and we had long warning of it. It marched very slow because of the number of captives that were led. Then we thought to deal our small stroke in the war, and we ambushed the orcs with all the bowmen we could muster, and hoped to save some of the prisoners. But alas, as soon as they were assailed, the foul orcs slew first the women among their captives, and the daughter of Aradreth they fastened to a tree with a spear."
Turin stood as one mortally stricken.
"How do you know this?" he said.
"Because she spoke to me before she died," said Dorlos. "She looked upon us as though seeking one whom she had expected, and she said,
'Mormagil, tell the Mormagil that Finduilas is here.'
She said no more, but because of her latest words we laid her where she died. She lies in a mound beside Taglin. It is a month now ago."
"Bring me there," said Turin,
and they led him to a hillock by the crossings of Taglin. There he laid himself down, and a darkness fell on him, so that they thought he was dead. But Dorlos looked down at him as he lay, and then he turned to his men and said,
"Too late. This is a piteous chance. But see, here lies the Mormagil himself, the great captain of Nargothrond. By his sword we should have known him, as did the orcs."
For the fame of the Black Sword of the South had gone far and wide, even into the deeps of the wood. Now therefore they lifted him with reverence, and bore him to Efel Brondir. And Brondir, coming out to meet them, wondered at the bier that they bore,
Then, drawing back the coverlet, he looked on the face of Turin, son of Hurin, and a dark shadow fell on his heart.
"Oh, cruel men of Holoth," he cried. "Why did you hold back death from this man? With great labor you have brought hither the last bane of our people."
But the woodman said,
"Nay, it is the Mormagil of Nargothrond, a mighty orc slayer, and he shall be a great help to us if he lives."
Note 21. In the story, as told in the Silmarillion, page 216, Brondir's foreboding of evil came upon him after he had heard the tidings that Dorlos brought, and therefore, as it appears, after he knew that the man on the bier was the Black Sword of Nargothrond, rumored to be the son of Hurin of Dorloman. End of note.
"And were it not so, should we leave a man woe-stricken to lie as carrion by the way?"
"You should not, indeed," said Brondir.
"Doom willed it not so."
And he took Turin into his house and tended him with care. But when at last Turin shook off the darkness, spring was returning, and he awoke and saw sun on the green buds. Then the courage of the house of Hador awoke in him also, and he arose and said in his heart, "All my deeds and past days were dark and full of evil, but a new day is come. Here I will stay at peace and renounce name and kin, and so I will put my shadow behind me, or at the least not lay it upon those that I love."
Therefore he took a new name, calling himself Turambar, which in the high elven speech signified Master of Doom, and he dwelt among the woodmen and was loved by them, and he charged them to forget his name of old and to count him as born in Brethil. Yet with the change of a name he could not change wholly his temper, nor wholly forget his old griefs against the servants of Morgoth, and he would go hunting the orcs with a few of the same mind, though this was displeasing to Brondir, for he hoped rather to preserve his people by silence and secrecy.
"The Mormagil is no more," said he, "yet have a care lest the valor of Turambar bring a like vengeance on Brethil."
Therefore Turambar laid his black sword by and took it no more to battle, and wielded rather the bow and the spear. But he would not suffer the orcs to use the crossings of Taglan or draw near the mound where Finduilas was laid. Howth en Eleth it was named, the mound of the elf maid, and soon the orcs learned to dread that place and shunned it. And Dorlos said to Turambar,
"You have renounced the name, but the black sword you are still. And does not rumor say truly that he was the son of Hurin of Dorloman, lord of the house of Hador?"
And Turambar answered, "So I have heard, but publish it not, I beg you, as you are my friend." The Journey of Morwen and Nienor to Nargothrond. When the fell winter withdrew, new tidings of Nargothrond came to Dorioth. For some that escaped from the sack and had survived the winter in the wild came at last seeking refuge with Thingol, and the march wards brought them to the king. And some said that all the enemy had withdrawn northwards, and others that Glaurung abode still in the halls of Felagund, and some said that the Mormagil was slain, and others that he was cast under a spell by the dragon and dwelt there yet as one changed to stone. But all declared that it was known in Nargothrond, ere the end, that the black sword was none other than Turin, son of Hurin of Dorloman. Then great was the fear and sorrow of Morwen and of Nienor, and Morwen said,
"Such doubt is the very work of Morgoth. May we not learn the truth, and know surely the worst that we must endure?"
Now Thingol himself desired greatly to know more of the fate of Nargothrond, and had in mind already the sending out of some that might go warily thither, but he believed that Turin was indeed slain, or beyond rescue, and he was loath to see the hour when Morwen should know this clearly. Therefore he said to her,
"This is a perilous matter, Lady of Dorloman, and must be pondered. Such doubt may in truth be the work of Morgoth, to draw us on to some rashness."
But Morwen, being distraught, cried,
"Rashness, lord? If my son lurks in the woods hungry, if he lingers in bonds, if his body lies unburied, then I would be rash. I would lose no hour to go to seek him."
"Lady of Dorloman," said Thingol,
"that surely the son of Hurin would not desire. Here would he think you better bestowed than in any other land that remains,
in the keeping
of Melion. For Hurin's sake, and Turin's, I will not have you wander abroad in the black peril of these days.
You did not hold Turin from peril, but me you will hold from him, cried Morwen, in the keeping of Melion. Yes, a prisoner of the girdle. Long did I hold back before I entered it, and now I rue it.
Nay, if you speak so, Lady of Dorloman, said Thingol, know this. The girdle is open. Free you came hither. Free you shall stay, or go. Then Melion, who had remained silent, spoke.
Go not hence, Morwen. A true word you said. This doubt is of Morgoth. If you go at his will.
Fear of Morgoth will not withhold me from the call of my kin, Morwen answered. But if you fear for me, lord, then lend me some of your people.
I command you not, said Thingol. But my people are my own to command. I will send them at my own advice.
Then Morwen said no more, but wept, and she left the presence of the king. Thingol was heavy-hearted, for it seemed to him that the mood of Morwen was fey, and he asked Melion whether she would not restrain her by her power.
Against the coming in of evil I may do much, she answered, but against the going out of those who will go, nothing. That is your part.
If she is to be held here, you must hold her with strength. Yet maybe thus you will overthrow her mind.
Now Morwen went to Nienor and said,
Farewell, daughter of Hurin. I go to seek my son, or true tidings of him, since none here will do aught, but will tarry until too late. Await me here until haply I return.
Then Nienor, in dread and distress, would restrain her, but Morwen answered nothing, and went to her chamber, and when morning came, she had taken horse and gone. Now Thingol had commanded that none should stay her, or seem to waylay her, but as soon as she went forth, he gathered a company of the hardiest and most skilled of his march wards, and he set Mablung in charge.
Follow now speedily, he said, yet let her not be aware of you. But when she is come into the wild, if danger threatens, then show yourselves. And if she will not return, then guard her as you may. But some of you I would have go forward as far as you can, and learn all that you may.
Thus it was that Thingol sent out a larger company than he had at first intended, and there were 10 riders among them with spare horses. They followed after Morwen, and she went south through Rhegion, and so came to the shores of Sirion above the twilight mirrors. There she halted, for Sirion was wide and swift, and she did not know the way. Therefore now the guards must needs reveal themselves, and Morwen said,
Will Thingol stay me, or late does he send me the help that he denied?
Both, answered Mablung.
Will you not return?
No, she said.
Then I must help you, said Mablung, though it is against my own will. Wide and deep here is Sirion, and perilous to swim for beast or man.
Then bring me over by whatever way the elven folk are used to cross, said Morwen, or else I will try the swimming. Therefore Mablung led her to the twilight mirrors. There, amid the creeks and reeds, fairies were kept hidden and guarded on the east shore, for by that way messengers would pass to and fro between Thingol and his kin in Nargothrond.
Note 22. See page 153. Where there is a reference to Aradreth's exchanging messages with Thingol by secret ways. End of note. Now they waited until the starlit night was late, and they passed over in the white mists before the dawn. And even as the sun rose red beyond the blue mountains, and a strong morning wind blew and scattered the mists, the guards went up onto the west shore and left the girdle of Melion. Tall elves of Dorioth they were, gray-clad and cloaked over their mail. Morwen, from the ferry, watched them as they passed silently, and then suddenly she gave a cry and pointed to the last of the company that went by.
"Whence came he?" she said. "Thrice 10 you came to me. Thrice 10 and 1 you go ashore."
Then the others turned and saw that the sun shone upon a head of gold, for it was Nienor, and her hood was blown back by the wind. Thus it was revealed that she had followed the company and joined them in the dark before they crossed the river. They were dismayed, and none more than Morwen.
"Go back! Go back! I command you!" she cried.
"If the wife of Hurin can go forth against all counsel at the call of kindred," said Nienor, "then so also can Hurin's daughter."
Mourning, you named me, but I will not mourn alone, for father, brother, and mother. But of these you only have I known, and above all do I love, and nothing that you fear not do I fear.
In truth, little fear was seen in her face or her bearing. Tall and strong she seemed, for of great stature were those of Hador's house, and thus clad in elvish raiment, she matched well with the guards, being smaller only than the greatest among them.
"What would you do?" said Morwen.
"Go where you go," said Nienor. "This choice indeed I bring, to lead me back and bestow me safely in the keeping of Melion, for it is not wise to refuse her counsel, or to know that I shall go into peril if you go."
For in truth, Nienor had come most in the hope that for fear and love of her, her mother would turn back, and Morwen was indeed torn in mind.
"It is one thing to refuse counsel," said she. "It is another to refuse the command of your mother. Go now back."
"No," said Nienor. "It is long since I was a child. I have a will and wisdom of my own, though until now it has not crossed yours. I go with you, rather to Dorioth, for reverence of those that rule it. But if not, then westward. Indeed, if either of us should go on, it is I, rather, in the fullness of strength."
Then Morwen saw in the gray eyes of Nienor the steadfastness of Hurin, and she wavered, but she could not overcome her pride, and would not seem thus, save the fair words, to be led back by her daughter as one old and doting.
"I go on as I have purposed," she said. "Come you also, but against my will."
"Let it be so," said Nienor. Then Mablung said to his company,
"Truly it is by lack of counsel, not of courage, that Hurin's folk bring woe to others. Even so with Turin, yet not so with his fathers. But now they are all fey, and I like it not. More do I dread this errand of the king than the hunting of the wolf.
What is to be done?"
But Morwen, who had come ashore and now drew near, heard the last of his words.
"Do as you are bidden by the king," said she. "Seek for tidings of Nergothrond and of Turin. For this end are we all come together."
"It is yet a long way, and dangerous," said Mablung. "If you go further, you shall both be horsed and go among the riders, and stray no foot from them."
Thus it was that with the full day they set forth, and passed slowly and warily out of the country of reeds and low willows, and came to the gray woods that covered much of the southern plain before Nargothrond. All day they went due west, and saw nothing but desolation, and heard nothing, for the lands were silent, and it seemed to Mablung that a present fear lay upon them. That same way had Baron trodden years before, and then the woods were filled with the hidden eyes of the hunters. But now all the people of Narog were gone, and the orcs, as it seemed, were not yet roaming so far southward. That night they encamped in the gray wood without fire or light. The next 2 days they went on, and by evening of the third day from Sirion they were come across the plain and were drawing near to the east shores of Narog. Then so great an unease came upon Mablung that he begged Morwen to go no further. But she laughed and said,
"You will be glad soon to be rid of us, as is likely enough, but you must endure us a little longer. We are come too near now to turn back in fear."
Then Mablung cried,
"Fey are you both, and foolhardy. You help not but hinder any gathering of news. Now hear me. I was bidden not to stay you with strength, but I was bidden also to guard you, as I might. And this pass one only can I do, and I will guard you. Tomorrow I will lead you to Amon Ethir, the spy hill which is near, and there you shall sit under guard, and go no further while I command here."
Now Amon Ethir was a mound as great as a hill that long ago Felagund had caused to be raised with great labor in the plain before his doors, a league east of Narog. It was tree-grown, save on the summit, where a wide view might be had always of the roads that led to the great bridge of Nargothrond and of the lands round about. To this hill they came late in the morning and climbed up from the east. Then, looking out towards the high far-off, brown and bare beyond the river, Mablung saw with elven sight the terraces of Nargothrond on the steep west bank, and as a small black hole in the hill wall the gaping doors of Felagund. Note 23. In the Silmarillion, page 122, the High Far-Off, or Tower in Far-Off, are great wooded highlands. The description of them here as brown and bare perhaps refers to the leaflessness of the trees in the beginning of spring. End of note. But he could hear no sound, and he could see no sign of any foe, nor any token of the dragon, save the burning about the doors that he had wrought in the day of the sack. All lay quiet under a pale sun. Now, therefore, Mablung, as he had said, commanded his 10 riders to keep Morwen and Nienor on the hilltop, and not to stir thence until he returned, unless some great peril arose. And if that befell, the riders should set Morwen and Nienor in their midst, and flee as swiftly as they might, eastaway towards Dorioth, sending one ahead to bring news and seek aid. Then Mablung took the other score of his company, and they crept down from the hill. And then passing into the fields westward, where trees were few, they scattered, and made each his way, daring but stealthy, to the banks of Narog. Mablung himself took the middle way, going towards the bridge, and so came to its hither end, and found it all broken down, and the deep cloven river, running wild after rains far away northward, was foaming and roaring among the fallen stones. But Glaurung lay there, just within the shadow of the great passage that led inward from the ruined doors. And he had long been aware of the spies, though few other eyes in Middle-earth would have discerned them. But the glance of his fell eyes was keener than that of eagles, and outreached the far side of the elves. And indeed, he knew also that some remained behind and sat upon the bare top of Amon-Ethir.